We do want to continue our Bible study. So our Wednesday evening Bible study, we have been working through the Psalms, taking one psalm each week, and we have come to Psalm number 27. So Psalm 27 for our Bible study tonight. Our summary for this psalm. Psalm 27 exhorts us to wait with hope in the Lord because being lifted up in victory means unbroken fellowship with Yahweh in His presence. And I'll go over that again. Psalm 27 exhorts us to wait with hope in the Lord because being lifted up in victory means unbroken fellowship with Yahweh in His presence. All right, so to outline this psalm in halves, verses 1 to 6, expression of trust. Verses 7 to 14, exhortation to trust. And I'll go over that again. Verses 1 to 6, expression of trust. And verses 7 to 14, exhortation to trust. All right, so let's start with our observations of Psalm 27. Psalm 27 was written by David. You can see the superscription there, a psalm of David. So it is ascribed to David. There's no occasion for the psalm mentioned in the superscription. There's no musical directions that are given. The text of the psalm doesn't really give us any occasion or musical direction either. Psalm 27 is a psalm of confidence. It combines a number of elements of different psalm types, and we've been talking about psalm types and categories that we can put these psalms in as we've gone through them. Obviously, the most dominant is that of confidence or of trust, and that is explicitly stated in verses 2, 3, 5, 6, and 10. So that's certainly the predominant type of psalm. But it also contains elements of praise and elements of worship with mentions of the temple and of the sacrifices. It also contains elements of lament where we have expressions of confidence in the Lord as well as prayer for deliverance and crisis that is mentioned. It's also a psalm that we talk about as a Torah psalm or an instruction psalm, as you see some of the verses asking for teaching and for leading in God's ways. I could probably also throw in some wisdom elements there. It's also a psalm of predictive prophecy, and that primarily is seen by the ending exhortation to wait and to hope with confidence on God's salvation. That's obviously a future-oriented predictive look. Psalm 27 is most similar in its structure to Psalm number 26, the one that we just looked at last week. So, like Psalm 26, it begins with an expression of trust or an expression of confidence in Yahweh. We also see that at the center of both psalms is verses about God's house, dwelling in God's house. Both psalms also feature a seeking for vindication Vindication, we've seen a number of times in the Psalms already. Vindication is the vindication of the righteous. In other words, those that have put their trust in Yahweh have no reason to fear his coming judgment or the revelation of his wrath, because his wrath will be revealed and poured out against the unrighteous, the wicked, the evildoers, all of those that we see. And so the psalmist can even pray at times for God to rise up in judgment because his trust is in Yahweh and he has no reason to fear. This is a prayer for vindication. So we see that sort of thing in Psalm 26 and 27. And both psalms end with statements of hope, statements of confidence, and statements of trust. So structurally, Psalm 26 and Psalm 27 are very similar. Psalm 27 has a number of poetic features, and we've been talking about these. Obviously, this is poetry, Hebrew poetry, and there are a number of poetic features in Psalm 27. Probably the most common feature would be that of repetition. So, on the one hand, repetition connects the two halves of this psalm together. So you have mentions of salvation, for instance, in verse 1 and verse 9. Mention of enemies, verse 2 and verse 12. Mentions of heart that actually occur in verse 3 and verses 8 and 14. Being lifted up or rising, verse 3 and verse 12. Seeking, which appears in verse 4 and in verse 8. And also life, which appears in verse 4 and verse 13. So you have repetition as sort of a structural element in the way that this psalm is composed. And you also have repetition throughout where you will see statements made that are essentially parallel statements, and they're made with words that are certainly related, maybe not necessarily exact synonyms, but they are certainly related. You see that going throughout the psalm. The psalm does use some different imagery in it, one of those being military imagery. So we have a number of military terms, reference to warfare, hosts, and such. We have a little bit of imagery of light, not a lot in the psalm, but it is there. We also have reference to instruction or teaching, again, bringing in that wisdom aspect. We also have some legal imagery, particularly in the reference to false accusations. And so that basically the trouble in this psalm is presented through the military imagery and then presented through the legal imagery. So the false accusation would imply that someone is perverting, they're corrupting justice. They're using justice and they're using governmental authority to persecute, as well as warfare and encamping with a host. And then also there's the imagery of enemies as wild beasts, and we encounter that again. That's the most, as far as poetic features of the psalm goes. All right, so we do want to walk through this psalm, 14 verses. So let's read this psalm. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell. Though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. One thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. And now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy also upon me, and answer me. When thou saidst, seek ye my face, my heart said unto thee, thy face, Lord, will I seek. Hide not thy face far from me. Put not thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Leave me not, neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up. Teach me thy way, O Lord, and lead me in a plain path because of mine enemies. Deliver me not over unto the will of mine enemies, for false witnesses are arisen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thy heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. All right, so verse 1 begins this psalm with an expression of confidence, and we have encountered these repeatedly in the psalms as we've been working our way through them. This is a reference to the Lord is my light. Light is generally speaking a positive image. It is oftentimes set against darkness, darkness being negative, whether it would be sin or evil or enemies or whatever the case may be, or darkness can also indicate ignorance. Light is generally a positive image that will have to do with knowledge, with openness, with even can be associated with victory. And when it is paired together with salvation, as it is in this first line, it's indicating the whole salvation of man. So it's physical, it's spiritual, it's intellectual, you could even say, just the whole being of man, light and salvation. The word for strength refers to a fortified place. It could be a fortress. It could also be a place in a rocky mountain, a place that is naturally and easily defensible, a place to be hidden or concealed. And the question that's repeated here, and you see some of this repetition, whom shall I fear, of whom shall I be afraid? Fear and dread, as it's translated in other places sometimes. The question of fear is rhetorically stating that there's none to fear since Yahweh is light, salvation, and strength. In other words, it's the way the psalmist is communicating that my trust and my confidence is in the Lord, and there is no one to fear or to be afraid of. Verses 2 to 3 speak of past deliverance and present hope. And so sometimes we see confidence being expressed through based on the character or the nature of God. Sometimes we see confidence being expressed through past experience. And this is one of the cases we see here. The past experience where God has shown His faithfulness, He has shown His sovereignty, has shown His power and His salvation. So past deliverance yields present hope. We have here, and again we see some of this repetition, the wicked, the enemies, and the foes. And they have been persistent problems for David, especially as we've been going through the Psalms. And we also have here the first imagery of these enemies, and it's given as imagery of wild beasts. Notice it says in verse 2 that they came upon me to eat up my flesh. So this is imagery of wild beasts enclosing to devour. And we've seen similar things in Psalm 7 and verse 2, and Psalm 14 and verse 4, Psalm 17 and verse number 12. And then there's another imagery that is used of the enemies in verse 3, though a host should encamp against me, and then he goes on to say, though war should rise against me. So this would be the military imagery that we spoke of. There's like an army that has come out, a great and massive army that has come out and has encamped around David, and warfare is looming or threatening upon him. But you notice what he says in verse 2 of his enemies, they stumbled and fell. So here we have the past experience that brings hope in the present for future deliverance. So they came out upon me to devour me, but they stumbled and fell. In other words, they were not victorious. And so he's giving us here one of the themes that we see running throughout this psalm, and that is the theme of faith versus fear. Then we come to verses 4 to 6, and these are some of the central verses of this psalm, close to the center of it, but certainly thematically near the center of it. And he expresses his desire for God's house. Notice he starts there in verse 3, one thing have I desired of the Lord. And that's not a real common expression in the Psalms at all. But it is describing a singleness of mind, a singleness of purpose, a singleness of focus. One thing have I desired. So he's describing what is a greater desire or what is a supreme desire. So he asks for certain things in this psalm, deliverance from enemies being one of them, instruction from the Lord and being led in on level ground, which we saw that at the end of Psalm 26 as well. He asks for a number of things in this psalm, but this would be his supreme desire, that he might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of his life. So this psalm continues the theme of God's house, and we've talked about that in this grouping of psalms that we're in, going through Psalm number 30. There's a theme of God's house that runs throughout all of these psalms, and particularly in verse 4, the desire to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life reflects Psalm 23 and verse number 6 and that promise there. Now, the word for house is used in Psalm 5:7, Psalm 23:6, Psalm 26:8, and in Psalm 5:7, it's used, and what is expressed there is that the psalmist will come into God's house in the abundance of God's covenant mercy. In other words, how is he going to come into the house of the Lord? Well, he's going to come in through God's hesed, through his covenant mercy. And we also see some of the repetitions in these particular verses. We have house, temple, pavilion, tabernacle, and rock. All right, so these are all places that the psalmist is going to be. These are places that are representing fellowship in the presence of God, worship, safety, security. We also see repetition in his desire, seeking, dwelling, beholding, inquiring, hiding, and being set up, which speak of his deliverance and his victory and that he is pursuing. Verse 6 expresses that victory. My head, and now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. So he's expressing that victory and that deliverance. The lifting up is an expression of exalting to rule, and we've already encountered it in Psalm 3:3, Psalm 9:13, Psalm 18:48. These references to his head being lifted up, this is him being exalted. We've read them in the context of these psalms as the anointed of God being exalted to that place of kingship. And he also speaks, this verse also speaks of enemies being lifted up, or rather being lifted up above his enemies. And we have references in Psalm 12 and verse 8, Psalm 13 verse 2, to those enemies being exalted above God's anointed for a time. So here we are seeing that deliverance, we are seeing that exaltation, enemies being brought down, and God's anointed being lifted up to his rightful place. And that is followed in verse 6 by sacrifices and singing and praises. And all of that speaks of a victory celebration of the king when returning in triumph over his enemies. And so that echoes Psalm 22, verses 22 to 26, and especially in Psalm 24 and verses 7 to 10, those psalms that we looked at previously. The next stanza here, verses 7 to 10. Verses 7 to 10 is a prayer for help. All right, so he begins, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice." And the call to be heard has often been associated with vindication. We talked about that vindication. That call to be heard, this term is used in association with that vindication, and an expression of confidence for the righteous. In other words, the Psalms to this point have taught us that God hears the righteous when they call to Him, and God answers them, and God delivers them out of their trouble. So we see this in Psalm 4, verses 1 and 3, Psalm 5 and verse 3, Psalm 6, verses 8 and 9, Psalm 10, verse 17, Psalm 17, verses 1 and 6, Psalm 18, verses 6 and 44, and in Psalm 22, and verse number 24. So this is the cry, that cry of vindication to be heard. But he also prays, have mercy upon me. And that word is asking, in essence, asking God to be gracious and to have mercy often accompanies this prayer for vindication. So we see that in Psalm 4, 6, 9, 25, and 26 as well. We also have some repetition about the God's face, seeking His face, Him not hiding His face. The face of God indicates His presence and His pleasure. So His face indicates fellowship, and hiding His face refers to being forsaken or refers to abandonment. God's anger that is mentioned here in, that's verse number 9, put not thy servant away in anger. God's anger that is mentioned speaks of His wrath, and that word has been used that way in Psalm 2, verses 5 and 12. God's wrath against the rebellious nations there in Psalm 2. It's been used in Psalm 6 and verse 1, Psalm 7 and verse 6, also in Psalm 18 and verses 8 and 15, and Psalm 21 verse 9. Wrath or God's anger that's being referred to here, we have seen in the Psalms that it is reserved for the wicked and the evildoers. It's reserved for those who do not trust in God or walk in His ways. In other words, the enemies, the adversaries of God. And then we have this prayer at the end of verse 9 and then in verse 10 to not be forsaken or abandoned. And we've seen that term, the word that's used here for forsaken, which appears in verse 9 and 10. We've seen it in Psalm 9 and verse 10. We saw it in Psalm 16 and verse number 10, in Psalm 22 and verse number 1. Now, verse 10 is a strong statement of covenant love and loyalty. So it said here that Yahweh will not abandon, even though father and mother would abandon. Now, we've paid a lot of attention to the Hebrew word chesed, and that word means something like steadfast love, loving kindness, covenant mercy. It is associated with God's covenant faithfulness, Him fulfilling the promises that He has made. And that word doesn't appear in this psalm. But this verse is one of the strongest covenantal expressions of faithfulness that we find in the Bible. And in fact, it echoes promises such as found in the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 49 and verse number 15. This is words spoken to Israel. Can a woman forget her sucking child that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget. But Yahweh says, yet will I not forget thee. Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. So we see in the prophet Isaiah using that sort of imagery to convey his covenant faithfulness. He says, basically, it's like saying a mother and a father will forsake and forget their own child before I will forsake and forget you. That's a strong promise to those who are in covenant with God. And this being forsaken was actually prophesied in the curses of the covenant. So that they would be forsaken by father and mother is actually prophesied toward those who refuse to keep God's word, to walk in His ways, and to put their trust in Him. So Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 29 one of the places where that curse appears. And in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 56 and 57, which is another place where that curse appears. But this expression back here in Psalm 27 is an expression of confidence. He says, when my father and my mother forsake me, and what I understand from the grammatical construction of the Hebrew and the scholars that study these things, this is a conditional statement. So it's sort of like saying, if my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up. So it is a conditional statement, but it's confidence that the Lord will not forsake. That's the expression that he is giving us. And it's at the end of the phrase, it says, then the Lord will take me up. And that's actually the very same word that appears in Psalm 26:9 and is translated gather. And there the prayer was, gather not my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloody men. So in other words, God will not forsake him, though mother and father might forsake. God will gather him up as a son, as a child. That's the promise. Then we come to the next stanza, verses 11 and 12. And in verses 11 and 12, we have prayer for instruction and prayer for deliverance. And this is very similar to Psalm 5 and verse 8, as well as Psalm 23 and verse 3, to be led in the paths of righteousness. In other words, this prayer is delivered by one who wants to go in the good way, as the blessed man that we started the Psalms with in Psalm number 1. The crisis has been created in verse 12 by false witnesses that have risen up. This, again, this implies the perversion of justice in a legal setting to destroy the righteous one. And false witnesses are another that have been a persistent concern and source of trouble in the Psalms. So Psalm 4, 5, 10, 12, and 15 all have these references to false witnesses as a source of trouble. Then the final stanza, verses 13 and 14, and we have here an exhortation to wait in hope. So most of this psalm has been addressed to the Lord, and these verse in 13 and 14, in essence, are addressed to the community of covenant, the community covenant, or the covenant community. I kept saying that backwards. The covenant community. Those who trust in the Lord. So seeing the goodness of the Lord, as he says in verse 13, seeing the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, all right, that is not an extremely common phrase, but it is one that indicates the blessing, that future blessing that awaits the righteous. The unrighteous, we learn, are going to be rooted out of the land of the living and not remain in it. And so we saw, for instance, in Psalm 1, verses 5 and 6, how that the ungodly and those that walk in their counsel opposed to God, the wicked, the evildoers, they will be blown away like the chaff. They will not remain. They're not going to stand in the congregation of the righteous. Psalm 52:5 also has a statement about them being cut off from the land of the living. And there's also another statement in Proverbs chapter 2 and verse number 22 that they will be cut off from the land of the living. So not being cut off, in other words, living and dwelling in the land of the living is a blessing to the righteous. So this psalm ends with verse 14, which is a direct address of exhortation to wait on the Lord. So this is an urging of patience and perseverance and confidence in the Lord. The word for wait that is used here includes the idea of waiting expectantly. So hope is a good term because it's not just a waiting, but it's a waiting with expectation. There's hope in the waiting and in the patience. All right, any questions before we move on to interpretation? All right, so interpretation. So what does Psalm 27 teach? Psalm 27 teaches the alternatives of faith or fear. We talked about that as a theme in the psalm. And you'll notice in this psalm, faith is not set over against unbelief, but rather it is opposite of being afraid. So faith, believing, trusting in God, is set against being in dread and being in terror, being afraid. Now, one of the warnings for forsaking God's covenant and failing to trust in Him is that they will be handed over to fear. This is what Israel was told. So back in Leviticus 26, verses 15 and 17 and 36, He tells us that they're going to run like they're being pursued, but no one's chasing them. They're going to be gripped by fear. In other words, because they have not believed God and His Word, and they have not trusted in Him, they're going to run when no one pursues. And they're going to be shaken at the falling of a leaf, essentially, what He speaks of in there. So fear is one of the consequences that was prophesied to come on them for failure to believe in the covenant. So what we have in Psalm 27 is we have the absence of fear because the psalmist believes Yahweh and trusts in Him. So this is an expression of covenant faithfulness. His trust in Yahweh means that there's none to fear. There's none to be afraid of. Who is greater than the Lord? So there is none to fear. Psalm 27 also teaches us to seek God's kingdom first. The central concern of the psalm is the foremost desire for God's house. And the foremost desire for God's house is for unbroken fellowship in His presence. And this is reflective of Jesus' words in Matthew chapter number 6. This is a part of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter number 6, as Jesus taught this sort of kingdom focus and priority. Verse 31 says, "Therefore take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? For after all these things do the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that you have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all those things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." So this were Jesus' words spoken in the face of life's anxieties. You know, what are we going to eat? What are we going to wear? And how are we going to be sheltered? And even as we come back to this psalm and we think about the crisis of enemies and false accusers and all of those sort of things. And so right in the middle of this psalm, we have that sort of a seeking of God's kingdom first. One thing have I desired. So that also reminds us that mindset is a future orientation. And that's echoed at the end with the exhortation to wait. Verse 11 shows us that the supreme desire of the psalmist is to know God and to be with Him. That's the supreme desire. In other words, he asks for deliverance from enemies. He asks for protection, to be lifted up. He asks to be hidden within God's fortress. He does ask for those things. But even over and above the deliverance of the enemies that are presently pressing in upon him, his desire, his supreme desire is expressed as the desire to know God and to be with Him. All right, and that brings us to the Messianic hope, in Psalm 27. Now, Psalm 27 doesn't immediately seem to have the typical references to Messianic hope that we maybe have come to expect. But Psalm 27, when we look at it closely, has very strong connections with Psalm 22. Psalm 22 that we studied previously obviously is a messianic psalm that speaks so much to Jesus' death. So we have Psalm 27 and Psalm 22, and if we lay them alongside one another, here's what we're going to see. So Psalm 27, verses 2 and 3, show the psalmist being surrounded by enemies and even images of wild beasts that are surrounding him to close in on him and devour him. And that's actually the same that we find in Psalm 22, verses 12 to 16. And we know that that was fulfilled in the life of Jesus Christ in the prophecy of Psalm 2:2 about the rulers of the world setting themselves against them. And then we have the words of the apostles in Acts chapter number 4 and verse number 25, who by the mouth of thy servant David has said, why did the heathen rage? He's beginning to quote Psalm 2 here. Why did the heathen rage and the people imagine vain things? The kings of the earth stood up and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. He was surrounded by his enemies and even pictured them as being wild beasts. So that's a clear connection we see between Psalm 27 and Psalm 22. All right, next, if we go to verse 6 of Psalm 27, we see the exaltation of the anointed king and the victory feast, his head being lifted up above his enemies round about him, and then the offering of the sacrifices of joy, the singing of praises unto the Lord in his tabernacle. Well, this is also reflected in Psalm 22, verses 22 to 26, where we see that victory feast. And this also corresponds to the same prophetic imagery in Psalm 23, verses 5 to 6, that he's prepared a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Also in Psalm 24, verses 7 to 10, where we see the King of Glory entering into the city with all the great celebration. This exaltation, this being lifted up above his enemies, is captured very well in three particular references, if you want to look these up. Philippians chapter 2, verses 9 and 11, about the exaltation of Christ. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 20 to 23. And Colossians chapter 1, and verse number 18. These verses speak about the exaltation of Christ, and even specifically being lifted up over and above his enemies. We also have in Psalm 27, in verses 9 and 10, we have an abandonment theme in this psalm. The thought of being forsaken, of God hiding and being far from him. Well, if you remember, that is actually a very dominant theme throughout Psalm 22, which begins with those words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That we know Christ spoke from the cross as well. So in verse 1 of Psalm 22, and particularly in verses 9 to 11, we have this same abandonment theme. Again, the same term for forsaken is used in Psalm 9:10. It's used in Psalm 16:10, which Psalm 16 is another highly messianic psalm speaking of his body not being left in the grave in Psalm 16:10, not being forsaken of God. And so this is also echoed in the prayer that Jesus prayed in John chapter number 17. In John chapter 17, this is before the crucifixion, Jesus praying. And here's just one verse of what he prayed. He said, and now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. Jesus had a desire to see God's face. And he knew that he was going to endure this abandonment on the cross when he saw not God's face in fellowship and in love and in pleasure but when God's wrath was poured out upon him. So we also see in Psalm 27 that same prayer asking to not be taken in with the wicked, not to be destroyed with the wicked or whatever, but to be delivered. And then back in Psalm 27 and verse 13, we have this hope of the land of the living, and that is the kingdom to come for the righteous. And we see that reflected as well in Psalm 22, verses 27 to 31. And you remember what happens at the end of Psalm 22 is that this celebration and this victory feast expands to be this worldwide celebration and feast in the kingdom, involving all of the nations, those that have trusted in him. So that's the messianic hope of this psalm. All right, move on to application. Any questions about anything in the interpretation? All right, application. What does Psalm 27 particularly say to us as readers? Number one. Psalm 27 helps us understand power over the earth. Trust in God is most important. That should be our supreme desire and goal, or what we are trusting in. Ultimately, coming to live in God's presence is more important, and it is more desirable than whatever our present anxieties are. And I know that there are issues, and sometimes we're worried about things that are trivial. Sometimes we're worried about things that really are weighty. And sometimes there are life and death issues. But we also see in a psalm like this that ultimately coming to be in unbroken fellowship in the presence of God is more important than any of the anxieties and the worries that we have on this earth. And that actually helps us to face them. It helps us to cope with them. It helps us to deal with them and to encourage one another in the way. Number two, Psalm 27 helps us understand that faith is the alternative to fear or to being afraid. So put it the other way, lack of faith in God does not free one from fear, but rather subjects and enslaves one to all fears. We really become afraid when we're not trusting in God. Number three, Psalm 27 helps us understand that Jesus' victory is our victory. His being exalted above his enemies ultimately means our exaltation above our enemies, our deliverance. So our hope is to live in the land of the living when all the wicked have been rooted out of it. So his victory is our victory. All right, any questions on Psalm 27 then?